Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, March the 8th, 2016. 12:12 coming up on 12:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're tuned into the Now program with Scott Spears, and I don't want you to leave your radio dial for the next 2 hours. Coming up in hour number two, we're going to pay tribute to an Ohioan, legendary Ohio figure, Bud Collins, legendary tennis broadcaster who sadly passed away last Friday at age 86. We will be joined by his wife, Anita Clausen, in her first interview coming up in hour number two since Bud's passing last Friday, coming up at 1:10 today. This hour, we're going to continue our remembrances of former First Lady Nancy Reagan, who passed away on Sunday at the age of 94. And we just got the news late last night that Mrs. Reagan will be laid to rest this coming Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. our time, at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. Joining us this hour to remember Mrs. Reagan is a gentleman, a historian, a legendary guy himself, who put together the Reagan Diaries a few years ago, chronicling the presidency of Ronald Reagan through his own writings, Douglas Brinkley. Mr. Brinkley, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, and most importantly, I grew up in Ohio, and I'm a graduate of The Ohio State.
We have something in common already.
Yeah, grew up in Perrysburg, Ohio, near Toledo.
Ah, very nice. Mr. Brinkley, the Reagan Diaries, how did that come about?
Well, I had written an article for The New Yorker called Ronald Reagan's Pen Pal, about a woman named Lorraine Wagoner, who was a huge Ronald Reagan movie buff, a fan of, created a Reagan fan club back in the 1940s when Reagan was just getting going. And they had a lifelong correspondence, and she reached out to me from Philadelphia. She was a Democrat. Her job was with the IRS. And she called me and said, I have 240 letters that Ronald Reagan wrote me. And I thought that probably was form letters, you know, just mimeographed letters for fundraising or something. But she convinced me, she wouldn't fax me any to come look at them, but she convinced me to come to Philadelphia, and lo and behold, they were all genuine. And I wrote an article in The New Yorker that Nancy Reagan thought was really interesting because she knew Lorraine Wagoner well and liked my piece. And then I wrote a book called The Boys of Pointe du Hoc about Ronald Reagan's speeches over in Normandy for the D-Day anniversary when he was president, and she liked that, and so word got back to me that there was a daily White House diary that Ronald Reagan kept every single day, except for the days when he was healing from being shot in 1981, and that she was looking for somebody to turn all of this raw primary material over to, and so I went out and met Mrs. Reagan, a former California Governor Pete Wilson set the meeting up. I went and met her at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and we talked all about it, and we started developing a relationship, and eventually she turned over this massive trove of materials to me, and I had to move out to Simi Valley to work on what became the Reagan Diaries.
What was meeting Mrs. Reagan like? Because by all accounts, she was very protective of President Reagan.
Well, I was pre-warned that she had been burned by a historian named Edmund Morris, who wrote a book called Dutch, that when Ronald Reagan was in the White House, they had given access to this scholar, and he ended up fictionalizing the book, turning it into kind of a novel, and she was very bitter and angry about that, but she was in a conundrum. She knew that her husband kept his daily diary. It was unbelievably voluminous and interesting for history, and she couldn't squelch it, and so she knew she had to go find somebody that that she could work with. And I said to her during that first luncheon, I subsequently became friends with her, but at the first luncheon I say, well, you know, some people might criticize you thinking me, I'm not a conservative movement Republican. And she just glared at me and said, my son is more liberal than you'll ever be. What's your point? And I said, I don't know, I guess I don't have a point. And we talked about movies and her career, and her only early stipulation was that once the book came out, and I do interviews like I'm doing with you, Scott, I never would tell people what Ronald Reagan would do. She just can't, she could not stand it when pundits would go on television and say, well, Reagan would bomb in Syria, or Reagan would have, you know, boycotted that meeting, or she just thought that, as she framed it to me, her husband was a pragmatist. And yes, he came out of conservatism, but he was once a Democrat, and he tried to do what was right for the country at all times. She was very keen on her husband being remembered by all Americans, not just the people that mark R when they vote.
When you got a hold of the diaries, what was your take on them?
Well, I had to move to California, and every day I would sit in the library there and go through them, and I was stunned that he had the fortitude and the self-discipline to maintain them on a daily basis. I teach American history at Rice University, and I've written many books, and I studied the presidency. I'm right now the presidential historian for CNN. So I knew about James K. Polk's diaries. I knew Rutherford B. Hayes kept them. I knew some presidents dabbled in trying to keep them and failed, but the self-discipline of the daily and never letting go of it, I found mesmerizing and really incredible. And I came away, there are many, many takeaways. I couldn't possibly do them all on your show, but I did feel that he got very close to God after he was shot. He woke up, he was almost dead, he couldn't believe his eyes were opening, and he saw the ceiling of the hospital there at George Washington University, and he decided that the rest of his life would be devoted to God, and part of that was making the world a more peaceful place. He had been a Hollywood star, he had been elected president, and he thought the main thing was to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And in fact, his Secretary of State, George Shultz, is alive and well today out at the Hoover Institute in California, and he works all the time, Shultz, to rid the world of nuclear weapons. So Ronald Reagan began that journey and had Mikhail Gorbachev to negotiate with, and we see Reagan now as one of the Cold War president that was able to get serious arms reductions with the Soviets. That was one takeaway from the diaries.
When I saw, Nancy Reagan did very few interviews after this book came out, but I saw her on Larry King, and she had said that President Reagan did not write these diaries for publication. So were there things in there that were personal that she did not want in the book?
Oh, the whole diary is very personal, extremely personal, and what Reagan would use them for, let's say he was angry at Jesse Jackson or Tip O'Neill, or one of his Republican colleagues, he would vent in the diary instead of venting in public. He also would tell personal stories about how he felt, his moods, his love for Nancy, what's going on with his children. There's one diary insert where he's very angry at his son. And so these are highly personal in nature. Nancy Reagan never wanted me or cared if she wanted it all out. She wanted nothing saved, nothing held back, zero stipulation. In fact, as we became closer friends, the national security apparatus in America wanted to kill some of the excerpts because they were classified in their view. It dealt with Saudi Arabia, missile sales of weaponry, U.S. policy in the Middle East. And Mrs. Reagan weighed in on my behalf right heavily and said, I want everything open. She was for full disclosure, and she's that way about all of her husband's papers. Her faith in him is that anything he ever wrote, whether it be a letter, diary, memo, she wants released because she believes that he only wrote or recorded what were true reflections of his thinking, that he didn't really have a Machiavellian side that she needed to cover up in history.
When I know that you said that she wanted everything out there. Having been burnt by Edmund Morris on the Dutch biography, when this book was presented to her before it came out, is there anything she did not want in? Is there anything she did not like?
No, she liked it all. She wrote me a beautiful inscription. In the first copy I got, I met with her, and I've now donated that copy signed by both Nancy Reagan and myself to Eureka College in Illinois, where Ronald Reagan went to school. So it was a very, success breeds friends. I mean, the Reagan Diaries became a runaway number one bestseller week after week on the New York Times, so she was very pleased that the public embraced the diaries. And I think it served a purpose that she had, which was many people thought, well, Reagan did have a good presidency, perhaps, but he wasn't the brightest fellow, or he wasn't hands-on. So she knew the diary would start a revisionism of showing how cogent her husband was about what was happening around him during his two-term presidency.
Every Republican debate, almost every Republican candidate, mentions Ronald Reagan in some way. This was her husband. This was a very important person in her life. Did she understand how he had become in the last 30 years so revered by the Republican Party?
She did, and she liked that a lot. But and she knew that Republicans were always going to think he was great. But you get to the point, and it's when you're a legend, you can do this. She got to the point where she thought Ronnie, her husband, did worked on behalf of all Americans. So she loved it if a Democrat came up to her or wrote her and said, "I like your husband," because she wanted him to be an American president, the way we think of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. We don't think of those presidents about being a political partisan, per se. They become part of the fabric of our nation's past, and I think she hoped that he would emerge from the ghetto of being just the GOP, conservative movement leader, to being seen as a person who did an excellent job in the White House.
You're a presidential historian. Where do you put him?
He's ranked quite high. I mean, most historians think Lincoln's number one and George Washington two, Franklin Roosevelt three, Theodore Roosevelt four, Truman five. Then it gets cloudier. You get Jefferson in there, and Polk gets sometimes high marks. Lyndon Johnson by some people. But Johnson's Vietnam War was a disaster, so he goes sinking. I'd put Reagan there at that bottom part of the top 10, maybe, 8, 9 in the ranking of American presidents.
After the book came out and you became friends with her, what were her last years like, the last couple years?
Well, she was on a mission, and it'd be impossible to ever tell anybody in the media how all-encompassing this mission of hers was, to make Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday a few years back be celebrated. And it was important to her that she was able to be the organizer of a happy birthday to her deceased husband, who would have been 100. Once she got through all of that, she, I think, was ready to pass. I mean, she hit the 90 years old mark. Felt she was living on borrowed time. She had great problems with her hip and mobility and issues that anybody who makes it to 90 has. And she felt she lived a very good life, had no complaints. Obviously enjoyed spending time with her friends, gossiping about Hollywood, keeping up with her children. But I think she recognized that she was going to go soon, and she was a believer. She had faith that she would hopefully go to heaven and meet her husband there.
What surprised you about her?
She was a tough cookie, as they used to say. Larry King always called her, a great dame, that old-fashioned word. But she, she would tell you whatever she really thought. She had a laser-like directness that at first could seem cold, or even it threw you off your game a little, because most of us do a kind of a fake hello and kind of an etiquette, and she cut to the chase, was very direct, and that turned out to be what I admired and loved about her, because when I was working on the diaries, if I had a question, you knew you could go with her and she'd give you a quick, direct answer. There was never a round. She didn't play the runaround game. And so it was useful for me in that regard. But also, you know, my mother and father, who I mentioned to you, we grew up in Ohio. They've now retired and in their late 80s living in California. And, you know, there's something about a certain age you get in life, 80s and 90s, you're able to say whatever you want without much of a consequence. You could be direct because you've earned it.
What was your last conversation with her like?
All about her husband and how what was going on at the library. She stayed deeply involved with that. But in the last year or two, you know, she's recoiled a lot from any public events, and it's really, with the exception of going with Joanne Drake, and a woman named Ren Powell, who ran her calendar. She was no longer the social maven, a public figure anymore. She was living a life of intense privacy, coping with her aging.
Want to get two quick questions in here because I know you're very busy, but something in recent months that happened was Bill O'Reilly's publishing of the book Killing Reagan, which a lot of Reagan loyalists have not liked. Was she aware of that book?
I do not know. I do know that she told me very directly and many times that she did not believe that Ronald Reagan had any signs of Alzheimer's in the White House. And in fact, in the diaries, his last year, he seems more mentally vigorous than ever. However, he wrote a couple of inserts. One, I remember, I might have this a little wrong, but he wrote something like, I put eardrops in my eyes by accident. I've never done something that foolish before. And he wrote another insert, I'm flying over, I'm really frustrated, I'm flying over a canyon I know well, and I can't think of the name of it. And then a little bit later he says, Topanga Canyon. So he was finding, I think, just that his memory may have been slowing down slightly, but she feels that was not all early Alzheimer's, that they went horseback riding in Mexico, and he got thrown off a horse and hit his head on a rock. And it was a very serious head injury. They waited a little while and then went to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and that's when they were there that they were he was diagnosed. So she never believed that her husband had Alzheimer's while he was president.
Her children have had kind of a unique relationship with her, sometimes good, sometimes bad. Now that Nancy Reagan is gone, because there is such a... there is such a fascination with the fact that this president, because he was so popular, still is so popular, for 10 years was out of the public eye with Alzheimer's, didn't seem, no pictures, nothing written about that time. Nancy Reagan very protective about that. Is there a fear now with her gone that information like that from people who were around might make it to the forefront?
I'm not quite sure I get the question.
With her being such a fierce protector of his legacy, right, this last part of his life not being in the public eye,
right,
is never really talked about. Will it be...
No, I don't know if it's not talked about. I mean, he wrote a goodbye letter to the country that's very celebrated, and it's sort of the linchpin to the PBS documentary on him. There are some photos of him in a park bench with Alzheimer's and all. They haven't hit the public imagination in those ways, but she wasn't trying to hide the Alzheimer's. In fact, she spent the rest of her life talking almost exclusively about the Reagan Library and Alzheimer's, because she became a campaigner, went on Capitol Hill and hooked up with Senator Ted Kennedy, who became a friend of hers, to try to do stem cell research and all of that. So I think she thought of herself as a pioneer of starting to get a national conversation going about Alzheimer's.
Were there people, do you know, were there people around him in the last stages of his life, maybe 2000 to 2004? Were people still allowed to see him?
Oh, yeah, he would see people. They had him in an office there in Century Plaza or whatever they call it there by Bel Air, Beverly Hills, a high rise there, and he'd have his office, and I've been in the office before, and he would come in and do some things, but less and less, because I think Mrs. Reagan wanted people to remember her husband as the vigorous man that he was for so many decades, not be left with that odd moment of suddenly he doesn't recognize you when you were somebody that was once prominent in his life. And that's the pathos and anguish of Alzheimer's, that it kind of it disorients people that interact with you.
The question I want to part with, because you're a great historian and have written so many great books, is where does she go in the pantheon of first ladies? But I do want to bring up something, just an opinion question. Because he was so popular for so many years, and I understand, I think as we all do, that Alzheimer's strips the memories away, I was always shocked, though, that there were not more photo ops where he didn't talk, knowing now that he still went to the office.
Well, the thing is, it's not, you don't look when you have Alzheimer's. There are some photos, and they did photo ops there, but you don't look, but photograph is deceptive, because they look fairly healthy in a photograph when you have Alzheimer's. It wasn't like he had a disfiguration or something, so those photos would be there. What didn't occur were tape recorded interviews or talks like we're having, because that wasn't deemed appropriate. George Herbert Walker Bush right now was recently, I teach at Rice in Houston, and he goes to baseball and basketball games. He says hello, but he doesn't do extensive interviews because he's slowed down, the mental capacity is slowed down to such a degree that it's just, it would be predatory to try to do something like that.
Well, I guess just where I was going with that in a small way is that, because I understand he was still walking and going to the office, I mean, to have him walk out at a convention and just wave might have been a bit, because he's...
He was there all, people saw him all the time. I mean, even when he had Alzheimer's, he'd regularly come up to his office, but it was just for meet and greets of a private nature. He was no longer a public figure.
Right. Where does Nancy Reagan go in the history of first ladies?
Oh, stands very large, but for different reasons. She's not Eleanor Roosevelt, who's writing a weekly column, My Day, and pioneering on the role of outspokenness on women's rights, civil rights. Where Nancy Reagan is one of them, maybe a little closer, like Dolly Madison was to James Madison. Very, very well known for her for being the protector of her husband, but also his alter ego, seen as one of the great love stories. Ronald Reagan didn't make any major decision without also confronting her. So her power is considered very large, but it's also very elusive, because it's more of a pillow talk variety than memorandum or My Day columns in newspapers.
Douglas Brinkley, author of The Reagan Diaries, thank you so much for giving us these few minutes, a fellow Ohio boy.
Yeah, thank you for doing what you do for Ohio. It's greatly appreciated.
Hey, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Douglas Brinkley, author of The Reagan Diaries, and if you haven't read that book, very, very interesting book. You ought to get your hands on that. What's your thoughts on Nancy Reagan? Give us a call, 740-383-9944. 740-383-9944. Give us a call and we will put you up on the air. Certainly a lot of adulation placed her way in the last few days, and maybe very well deserved and very well put for everything that she did. Nancy Reagan was a legend. We've got the Bud Collins tribute coming up in hour number two today. You want to stay on the line. We're going to take a quick break here, but come back if you're on the line, want to get on the line and talk with us, give us a call. Remember, Charles Grodin, actor, activist, commentator, just done about everything. Charles Grodin, and he's always fun on the program, tomorrow, Wednesday, March the 9th at 1:10 p.m. Coming back on the other side of this, hold on a second here. We'll get the break in here in a second. But if you're out there, please do give us a call. We would love to hear from you and know what you think. Do you think Ronald Reagan is ranked properly in the list of presidents? I don't know. A lot of people feel so, a lot of people feel not. It's very, very interesting when you look at how presidents are ranked. Dolly Madison, is that where Nancy Reagan should be ranked? I don't know. It's, I guess it's all in the eye of the beholder, as they say. As so many things are, as time goes on. Okay, now we're going to take a quick break and come back with much more on this program right after this.
Everybody's talking about Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard, performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the Tomb of King Tut, there's a Chuck Full of Nuts and McDonald's. At La Scala, they sing by a big Burger King where the styrofoam boxes go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Taco Bell went and franchised a wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
Actress and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
What would we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott? Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire. I will do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. But well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me.
Hey, Scott Spears back with you here, 39 minutes past the hour, and next hour we're going to pay tribute to Bud Collins. Right now we're going to listen to an interview I did with Bud Collins, Christmas Eve, 2008. Here we go.
Now, speaking of not taking yourself too seriously, I have to ask this question. I'm sure you've been asked.
Oh, wait a second here. If I get the right thing queued up, we might listen to Bud Collins here.
This is Scott Spears, and today we're joined by, in my estimation, one of the greatest broadcasters ever to pick up a microphone, the great Bud Collins. Bud, how are you doing?
Well, Scott, that's a nice introduction. I appreciate it, and thank you. I'm doing fine. I'm in Florida right now, and as soon as I finish this, I'm going to take a swim.
Hey, well, I... It certainly is. Well, Bud, I kind of want to start this interview back as far as we can go back, because I think a lot of people might be interested in this. What was your childhood like?
Well, it was a very nice childhood. I grew up in the small town. It was a small town then anyway, called Berea, outside of Cleveland, the home of Baldwin Wallace College. And, of course, we had the college fields to play on, and we had a wonderful school system in Berea. I hope they still do. Fine teachers. And I sort of stayed in Berea. I went to Baldwin Wallace College, and then I went into the Army and turned up in Boston to go to graduate school, got a job with the Boston Herald as a sports writer, moved on to the Globe, Boston Globe, in 1963. Been with them ever since, but 1963 was also a big year for me because I started doing television on the public station in Boston. In those days, it was called educational television. Now it's PBS. But we were the first, really, to do tennis fully, a whole tournament, match after match, day after day. A guy named Greg Harney was a marvelous producer, director. And it was only in Boston for a couple of years. But in 1968, PBS became national. And a fellow named Arthur Ashe, nobody had ever seen him on television. He'd had a few stories written about him. He came to Boston as a lieutenant in the U.S. Army to play in the U.S. Amateur Championships. And we had that on PBS. And that was a revelation to people, to see this young black man playing tennis so well. And then 2 weeks later, he went to New York to play in the first U.S. Open. And he was certainly, he was seeded fifth, but Rod Laver was the favorite to win the tournament. However, Cliff Drysdale, who you know now is a wonderful television commentator, Cliff Drysdale upset Laver, opened the way for Ash, and Ash won the U.S. Open. And nobody will ever do that again, an amateur winning the amateur championship and the U.S. Open, because it's just too tough for an amateur. Anyway, after the Boston win by Ash, I got a phone call from CBS, a guy at CBS who'd seen me on Channel 13 in New York, asking me if I'd be interested in doing the U.S. Open, first Open, and I did that with Jack Kramer, and that's when my life changed radically into doing more television than sometimes more newspaper work. But I didn't want to leave the newspaper work, and I think I covered a lot of, if you'll be surprised at this, I covered boxing. That was my first beat.
Wow.
It was a strong sport in Boston in those days, in the 1950s. And I covered most of Muhammad Ali's big fights, including the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire in 1974. So that gives you pretty much a thumbnail of what I've been doing. And I'm still trying to do. I'm with ESPN now after 35 years with NBC. And I'm also with Tennis Channel.
Did you have any ill will when NBC and yourself parted ways?
Not a bit, because I'd had 35 fine years, and that's, and then they said, well, we want to see you on our station, so our network, I should say. So I wasn't unemployed very long.
What was covering the Rumble in the Jungle like?
Well, it was a tremendous experience, because it was so weird. I went over twice to Zaire. I went over in September and for the fight which was scheduled, and then George Foreman, Ali's opponent and holding the heavyweight title, was cut in sparring. So I had to go back to the United States, and nobody believed that fight would ever come off, because Mobutu, who was the dictator in Zaire, wouldn't let the fighters out of the country. They wanted to come home. They'd been there long enough. And so they reschedule it. And the rescheduling in October was during the annual rainy season. And people said that fight will never come off. It was an outdoor fight. And because of the rainy season, which will just wipe out any sporting activity during that time. Well, we got there for a second time. Didn't rain yet. Ali promised that it wouldn't rain until he'd won the title. And we'd heard a lot of boasting from Ali, who was a great guy. And sure enough, the rain held off until he knocked out Foreman in the eighth round. And this was another weird thing. The fight started at 3 in the morning, so it could get back to the East Coast of the United States at 10 p.m. the previous night. So as soon as he knocked out Foreman, we all went, the reporters went down to the press room and started typing madly. We weren't going to make too many deadlines, but I guess I got it the first edition of the Globe. And then we heard a noise. It was a thunderstorm. And before we knew it, the press room was flooded. And we got out by taking off our shoes and socks and carrying our typewriters, mind you, no computers yet, carrying our typewriters over our heads and getting out. And we found Ali at his villa, standing out in the yard, rain dripping down, and he said, I told you that Allah would not let it rain until I regained my championship. So it made a wonderful story.
What a great story that is. Now, Bud, one thing I want to ask you, because I can't think of anybody better to ask this of than you. What makes a good broadcaster?
Well, that's, you just throwing those tough questions. I don't know what makes a good broadcaster. I think you have to have a distinctive voice, and I think I do. I think you want to be very well informed on what you're broadcasting, and I think you don't want to take yourself too seriously. After all, it's doing sports isn't Edward R. Murrow or something like that, or Cronkite. So you have to, I feel you have to have a little sense of humor, and not really take it too seriously, because sport is wonderful, but there are many more important things in our country.
Absolutely. Very well put. Now, speaking of not taking yourself too seriously, I have to ask this question. I'm sure you've been asked this many times, but one of the signatures of Bud Collins is the clothes.
Well, that's true.
The very loud clothes, the very loud way that you dress. Where did that all come about?
Well, it is a long story. It goes back to 1966 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just off Harvard Square. There's a tailor named Charlie Davidson, who's a fine friend of mine. And I came in there one day in 1966, and he said, "You look awful on television." I said, "What do you mean, Charlie?" And he said, "Well, you're wearing white trousers and a blue blazer, and you look like some guy at a yacht club." And he said, "I just happen to have some material, just got in, and I'll make you a pair of trousers, and if you don't like them, I won't charge you for them. But you have to wear them." Now, this was a Madras red and white plaid, which you wouldn't look at it twice today. But in 1966, I looked at it and said, when he made them, I said, "Charlie, I can't wear those." And he said, "You promised." And my wife at the time said, "You can't wear those." I said, "Well, I promised Charlie." So there was a Davis Cup series in Cleveland, of all places, and I was covering that for the Globe. And as I entered the stands, I wished it had been rainy so that I could have worn a raincoat and cover those pants. But I started to walk up the grandstand to the press box, which was at the top. And as I walked, I heard whistles and people screaming, oh, look at that, and so, that sort of thing. I thought, gosh, I wish I could just fall into a hole. But then I got up to the top and I sat down, took my seat, and I said, "Well, that was kind of fun." And so Charlie continues to be the guy who makes most of my trousers. Some are off the rack, very few, however. And usually what we do, my wife and I, my wife is a great woman at anything, but she has a sense of clothing. And wherever we go, I buy the fabric, and we bring it, if it's interesting, and we bring it back to Charlie, who makes the trousers. So he's made some from material from Bhutan, which is a Himalayan kingdom we visited once, and from Thailand, and from Zimbabwe when we covered Davis Cup there in 2000. Also some Aboriginal designs from Australia, and Maori design when I covered the tournament in New Zealand. So that's how it goes, Scott. And some people think it's ridiculous, and other people like it.
No, I think it's great. But this is not something that you would say wear in normal life. This is
no, no. And actually, when I'm going around, people are always saying to me, "Well, where are your pants?" And I say, "Gee, didn't I wear them today?" And they say, "No, I wear them on occasions. I have my Wimbledon trousers, which are strawberries, and they only get worn once a year. That's for the men's final, and so it's a lot of fun. And Charlie Davidson, who is now 82 years old, is still tailoring, still making them up, and I hope he does for years.
That's great. Now, Bud, what would you consider to be the highlight of this career of yours?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think that certainly Arthur Ashe winning that U.S. Open in 1968, and when he won the U.S. Amateur 2 weeks prior to that in Boston, with PBS we had lots of time for interviews, and that was a time of Black Power and Black Panthers and so on, and so I had to ask him, "How does that fit into your life?" And of course, he was a lieutenant in the Army. He couldn't say much about it. He said, "I just have to follow orders in the Army, and I can't be political." And then I asked him, how does it feel to belong, to play at a club? It was Longwood Cricket Club in Boston with grass courts. How does it feel to play at a club which would never allow you as a member? And he said, "Well, I disapprove, of course, of that status, and it has changed since then. But," he said, "I have to go where the game is played." And that was a good answer. I think Ali and Zaire was a wonderful moment. They've been so lucky. So many. I've been very lucky. Scott, I covered the war in Vietnam for a while, and I got out of that. I was scared every minute, and I've had some terrific assignments.
Has there ever been a low point where you just considered, I don't like what I'm doing?
Well, I always have those low points every once in a while, saying, you know, people say to me, why don't you retire? And I have thought about that for a time, and I thought, well, what would I do? So the low points vanish pretty quickly, but I think that the United States is in a crisis now, and I'm just hoping that Mr. Obama can pull us out. Well, he needs a lot of help to do it. So I think right now we're all in a low point, or pretty much in a low point. I'm lucky to have a job, and I feel grateful about that, but this country's in a lot of trouble. I think we have the brains to get out of it, but we have to overcome a lot of damage.
Absolutely. But, you know, being that it is Christmas Eve, and you are so very kind to join us on this Christmas Eve morning, do you have a memorable Christmas moment that sticks out in your mind?
Well, I'll tell you this. In Berea now, the house where I live has been demolished, and the area is part of the Baldwin Wallace campus. And if you walk down Graham Street, where I lived, you will see about six wonderful-looking Christmas trees, only they're much bigger. Well, every year when we had Christmas, my father would get a tree that could be planted on the 26th of December. So he planted these trees, and they're a silent memorial to him and my mother, and I get very emotional when I walk alongside those trees, because they represent childhood Christmases, which were always very good. Even during the Depression, my father was out of work for a while, but they scrambled, and my mother and father, and made it a wonderful childhood.
How often do you get back to Ohio?
Not very often. Not very often at all. The last time was in 2007. When I was asked to do the commencement speech at Baldwin Wallace, I was very honored by President Dick Durst. And it was an interesting time, though, because I got booed in many parts of that speech, because I said we are living in an age of anxiety. I said anxiety, but also amnesia. I said we don't get history, and we disregard history. I was in Vietnam, and I said, well, thank goodness this will never happen again. And here we are in two wars. And so when I said that, though, I guess Ohio wasn't going the way that it finally went in 2008. And I talked about huge corporate salaries and how we need better public education. So I got a few hisses and a few boos, and it upset my wife. And I said, come on, don't be upset. I had to say those things, and I've been booed before.
How will you spend Christmas this year, Bud?
Well, we're spending Christmas here in Longboat Key, Florida, where I've been spending Christmas every year since 1979. And my wife and I, we have three children with us. And that's how we're not all the children, but three of them. And we will have a swim, we may hit some tennis balls, we'll take a walk on the beach, and we'll have a nice dinner.
That'll be great. Bud, have you ever thought of an epitaph, how you'd like to be remembered?
Oh, gee, that's a great question. An epitaph. Well, gee, my wife just said in the background she wants a copy of this interview, and I know you'll supply it for her. An epitaph. Well, he tried hard and enjoyed what he did and made quite a few people happy.
Well, Bud, you certainly have made me happy on many occasions. I love the way you dress. I love the way you commentate. I think what you do is absolutely tremendous, and you've given me a lot of joy, and I'm sure a lot of others,
Tell me about yourself now. You're out there in Marion, is that correct?
Marion, Ohio.
I've been there. I have a great friend who I think still lives there. He's a school teacher. Her maiden name was Hildebrand when I knew her. And then it was Hawks. So Mrs. Hawks, maybe she's still in Marion, I hope so.
Maybe she's out there listening this morning.
I hope so. Marion, the home of our greatest president, Warren G. Harding. I always tell people that and get some very nasty looks.
Yeah, I've been here in Marion all my life and certainly enjoyed it. And certainly
you went to Ohio State, I gather.
I went to Ohio State, yes.
Well, I'll tell you about Ohio State. They have a football coach named Jim Tressel.
That's right.
And his father was Lee Tressel, who was a fraternity brother of mine at Baldwin-Wallace. Lee Tressel led Baldwin-Wallace to the Division III National Championship in 1978. He was a great guy. And so I've never met Jim Tressel, but I have sent him a letter every now and again saying congratulations, and he does a terrific job. And there's a story in the New York Times today, which is really, I got a laugh out of it because it tells, and I don't remember the fellow's name, but he's a new coach at Miami of Ohio. He's black, which is good, and he was at Notre Dame. And so this guy is quoted, he's going to Miami, and he says, this is the cradle of coaches, which is right. Paul Brown was the first. He never mentions Paul Brown, but he says Jim Tressel. So I said, my goodness, he better know that Jim Tressel went to Baldwin-Wallace.
That's right. The coach's name is Mike Haywood. We had that story on this morning.
Mike Haywood. So Mike has got to congratulate him on giving the job, because I saw a terrible statistic the other day in the Times that said that 50% of college football players are black and about 3% are the black coaches. And that just isn't right.
No, it just isn't right. We got to fix that.
And so Haywood's got to learn his history. He's got to get the name Paul Brown, who was the most famous of all coaches at Miami of Ohio.
Absolutely.
And that Jim Tressel went to Baldwin-Wallace.
Absolutely. Well, Bud, we're running short of time. I wish we could do this. We need to do this more often.
Well, you can do it any time, Scott. I know you have persevered. I've stood you up a couple of times, and I'm sorry for that. But if you'll call me back when you get off the air, I'll give you is this going to be available on a DVD or what?
I will be able to get this to you.
Okay, well, we'll give you the address. My wife will answer the phone.
I will do that. Thank you so much, Mr. Collins.
It's Bud, please.
I did it again.
Did it again, Scott.
And
I hope we'll meet one day.
So do I, and you have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Same to you, and a great new year. This country needs one.
Thank you. Right. Bud Collins, one of the all-time great commentators in any sport, certainly tennis his forte. Bud Collins, you can't say anything bad about him.
From Christmas Eve of 2008, sadly, Bud Collins passed away last Friday at the age of 86. Stay tuned. Much more coming up here on WWGH Radio.
Something that came in that would have been huge.
A huge...
lost me at the time. Show.